This week, our Bach journey takes us to the Weimar court. Ted, can we have the slide? Thank you. We'll focus on Bach's growth as a composer during his nearly 10 years in Weimar, a happy period when his family grew and he enjoyed working as a court organist and chamber musician with the generous musical resources of a court that was supportive of music and serious about religion. The oddity of this court was that it was ruled jointly by two dukes who didn't get along. Let's just say Bach managed to please both dukes. Since Bach composed much of his organ music in Weimar, we'll start with a look at how the organ was perceived in Bach's Lutheran world, and we'll listen to some chorale preludes that work well on our chapel organ, especially when they are played by our honored guest, Westminster's organist Jim Burns. Jim has graciously agreed to play for us during his busy morning, and we are most grateful. Here we go. In Bach's time, organ music was considered a kind of metaphorical bridge from the congregation to God. The placement and appearance of organs illustrated a heavenly symbolism, which Bach's congregations took for granted. The organ was seen as a representative of heaven, its music coming from a divine place. After all, the organ was typically positioned very high in the church, closest to heaven. In the Baroque, the decoration of organs with the symbols of heaven, angels, clouds, sun, and stars, provided a powerful visual context. Carved angels were most frequent, alone or playing instruments, such as trumpets for judgment, violins, harps, drums, and organs. Angels and clouds were often painted on the organ doors. Think about it. Seen from the main floor, the organ looked like it was in heaven with the angels. Bells added to the effect via an organ stop called the Zimbelstern, little tinkling bells that are activated by the organ's wind. The sounding bells were a reminder of Psalm 150's joyful call to praise God with the sound of cymbals. I'll pass around a book that shows some organs with heavenly decoration. I've marked the pages, and the blue sticky note marks Bach's organ in Weimar, which we'll talk about now. Sorry. There. The Weimar Palace Church was an extreme and beautiful example of the organ placed heavenward. The organist and other musicians performed from a dramatic domed rectangular gallery 65 feet above floor level. You can barely see it at the top. The ceiling above the organ was painted with clouds and angels. The church was called the Weg zur Himmelsburg, the Way to Heaven's Castle. You might recognize this name from the British conductor John Elliott Gardner's popular book, Bach in the Castle of Heaven. With this image in mind, we'll do some listening, beginning with a setting of Luther's famous and elegantly simple Christmas hymn, Vom Himmel hoch, number 111 in our hymnal. The voice of an angel calls, "From heaven above, to earth I come, to bring good news to everyone. Glad tidings of great joy I bring to all the world and gladly sing." Luther wrote the words one Christmas Eve for his children, the tune a little later. Bach set this chorale six times for organ in a variety of ways, including a whole set of canonic variations. We'll hear a charming setting from manuals that spins off from bits of the melody in sparkling scales to evoke the joy of Christmas. It sounds great with the organ's Zimbelstern. As you listen, think of the angel's voice singing from heaven, accompanied by celestial bells, just as Bach's congregation would have. First, Jim will play the tune, and then you'll hear what Bach does with it. Thank you. To me, that was heavenly and very much Christmas joy. Absolutely. Now we'll hear two chorale preludes from the Orgelbüchlein, or Little Organ Book, a collection Bach created in Weimar to cover the important days and seasons of the church year. The 46 pieces, all chorale preludes with pedal, were used to introduce the chorale before the congregation sang it. These are some of the most frequently performed short works of Bach. Even now, when organ students master the varied challenges of the Orgelbüchlein, they are well on their way to playing competently. First, we'll hear a tune that is heavily embellished in the right hand to create the optimum emotional effect. The left hand and pedal provide solid support. In the Baroque period, the musical expression of emotions was very important, just as it was later in the Romantic era. In the musical language of the Baroque, composers used lots of techniques to create different moods, from joy to contemplation to sorrow. One method of conveying intense feelings was the elaborate singing melody set against a steady, comforting accompaniment. While Bach certainly didn't invent this approach, he employed it with exceptional skill, as you'll soon hear. Our piece is especially beautiful, often played at funerals. Wenn wir in höchsten Nöten sein, when we are in the hour of utmost need. It's a prayer for God's help. What's interesting for us Presbyterians is that the source of the tune is the Genevan Psalter of 1542, John Calvin's Congregational Songbook, where the tune is set to Psalm 141, a psalm of lament. The composer is none other than Louis Bourgeois, who composed the doxology tune we sing every Sunday. Late in his life, Bach returned to this chorale prelude, as well as a version without the ornamentation, as part of a collection of new treatments of earlier organ chorales. now known as the Great 18 or the Leipzig Chorales, an offering to posterity. This chorale turned out to be the final one Bach worked on, left unfinished at his death. The new treatment wasn't changing the music dramatically, but it did have a different and prophetic text. For deinen Thron tret ich. I come before your throne, O God, and humbly ask that you turn not your gracious countenance from me, a poor sinner. Bach was ready for death with a Calvinist tune in his head. Now, we'll listen to the Orgelbüchlein version. You'll hear the Genevan tune first. That was beautiful. You could just feel the emotion coming out of that very short piece. It's like a tiny masterwork. Next, we'll hear another Orgelbüchlein chorale prelude. This one for Easter. Erstanden ist der Heilige Christ. The Holy Christ is risen. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Who is a comforter to all the world. Hallelujah, hallelujah. The chorale is from Luther's time, the text a translation from a 14th century Easter carol. You'll enjoy the surging lines that uplift the spirits with the resurrection news. Jim will play this as a true prelude, followed by the chorale. Easter joy. I don't know about you, but that gave me goosebumps. I loved it. For our last piece, we'll skip to Leipzig so that you can hear what Bach was composing in his older years. Our example comes from a collection called Klavierübung, or Keyboard Practice, Part 3, printed in 1739. The Klavierübung 3 contained settings of the six so-called catechism chorales, the ones that Martin Luther assigned for teaching the Lutheran basics. They were used regularly in worship. Each chorale is set twice, corresponding to Luther's small and large catechisms, a lengthy setting with pedals and a shorter one for manuals alone. In a practical sense, organists had a good resource for a variety of needs, and the manual pieces could come in handy during the winter when practicing the pedals in a cold church was unlikely for most organists. We'll hear the manual setting of Luther's paraphrase of the Ten Commandments, Die sind die heiligen zehn Gebote. These are the holy Ten Commandments. It's a little fugue. The fugue subject is based on the chorale, but you don't really notice. You do notice that this is a cheerful dancing piece. It's a jig. That may seem odd for the Ten Commandments, but it might be explained by Luther's words in the Small Catechism. We should cheerfully do what he has commanded. The Psalms also speak of delight in thy statutes and of rejoicing in the law. And so we'll delight in listening to this jolly piece, preceded by just a few measures of the tune, which is fairly dreary. Thank you. It was such a treat to have live music and not a recording. It makes all the difference. I think Bach now feels alive to us. Since we just heard a dance, it's a good time to talk a little bit about how dance rhythms figure prominently in Bach's sacred and secular music. First, dance rhythms with origins in France, Italy, and Spain were simply part of the musical style of Bach's time. So it was natural for Bach to draw on rhythms from dances such as the Allemande, Courant, Sarabande, Gigue, Gavotte, Bourré, and others. And it's no surprise that Bach was exceptional in his inventive use of these rhythms. He wrote quite a few sets of stylized dances, which were called suites or partitas. Of course, Bach's treatment of the dances was distinctive, more elaborate and complex than his contemporaries. It's delightful music, clearly defined in dance terms. However, Bach's use of dance rhythms went way beyond suites, appearing in pieces that don't have dance names. Here, the dance rhythms can be obvious or subtle. For example, a lilting jig, or gigue in French, is easy for our ears to catch, as we heard in Jim's last piece. But other rhythms seem to be pretty much embedded in the larger structure of the music. A good example is the sarabande, in triple meter with the stress on the second beat. Instead of one, two, three, you have one, two, three. Bach used this rhythm in some of his late organ chorales that are contemplative in mood. The effect of the subtly accented second beat is alluring. Between these extremes fall a variety of slow and fast dances. We may or may not be able to define them as we listen, but overall, to put it simply, the spirit of dance music infuses Bach's compositions. And it's another feature we can listen for and enjoy in Bach. Some people might question the appropriateness of dance rhythms in sacred music. First of all, many of the earliest congregational songs from the various Reformation traditions have rhythms that remind us of dance. These are rhythmic songs, jazzy to our ears. For example, the Genevan tune we know as Comfort, Comfort, Now My People, number 87 in our hymnal, begins like this. Bum, 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 ba-da-da-dum, bum, bum, ba-da-da-dum, bum, bum. The melodies were crafted so that the rhythm and the rhymed poetry fit elegantly together. The result was often dance-like and very appealing to the people. By Bach's time, most of these dancing rhythms had been straightened out to resemble the four-square hymns we know today. The Solid, a Mighty Fortress began as a much more rhythmic chorale. Da-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-da-dum, ba-ba-da-dum, ba-da-da-dum, bum. To my modern ears, the rhythmic tunes are a lot more fun to sing than the straightened-out versions, but they can be tricky for today's congregations. Despite this history, over the years, some critics have questioned the suitability of pairing dance rhythms and sacred texts in Bach's cantatas. The great 20th century Yale theologian Jaroslav Pelikan expressed his opinion on the subject. For Bach, dance was the expression of a spirit that had dedicated even its humor to the adoration of the holy. I think this is the perfect answer to any critic. The quote comes from Pelikan's lovely little book, Bach Among the Theologians, published in 1986. It was prompted largely by the many conferences and concerts celebrating Bach's 300th birthday in 1985, when scholars were beginning to look much more closely at the theological foundations of Bach's sacred works. For church people, this was a welcome trend. Now we'll move back to Weimar and look at a young prince who helped Bach's musical world expand. The two dukes who ruled the Weimar court were brothers. The younger duke's half-brother, Prince Johann Ernst, was around 12 years old when Bach and his family moved to Weimar. Johann Ernst was broadly gifted and talented, and he loved music. He learned violin as a small child and studied keyboard and composition from the age of 9. Sadly, Johann Ernst died at age 18 in 1715, months after Bach had turned 30. In the 7 preceding years, however, Bach had known the prince well, perhaps serving as a kind of young adult mentor. Bach championed the prince's compositions and transcribed 4 of them for harpsichord and organ. It's possible that Bach simply liked these youthful works and wanted the prince and others to enjoy playing the pieces when an orchestra wasn't around. It's also likely that Bach knew he would benefit from a positive relationship with a musical prince and his family. This is a good example of how Bach, throughout his career, worked to maintain positive and sometimes lucrative relationships with various courts. Today, we would call it networking, and Bach was very good at it. Prince Johann Ernst was also an avid collector of music in both manuscripts and prints, and his music library was open to Bach. For a musician like Bach, who had always studied works of other composers, this was a tremendous resource. And it got even better in 1713, when the prince brought back a large collection of new music from Amsterdam. Bach was no doubt thrilled and eager to dig in and absorb this new music. The Italian style was all the rage, and the collection included the latest Italian concertos, such as Vivaldi's L'estro armonico, published in Amsterdam only 2 years before. And in 1713-14, possibly at Johann Ernst's request, Bach transcribed at least 9 Vivaldi concertos, 3 for solo organ and 6 for solo harpsichord. Not surprisingly, Bach put his own stamp on the concertos, adding extra notes, ornaments, etc. You'll hear one of these in worship next Sunday, thanks to Jim. By 1714, Bach was integrating Vivaldi's concerto form, with its refrain for the full ensemble called a ritornello, in some of his keyboard works. And in 1714, Bach requested and was granted the title of concertmaster, a position just beneath Weisskapellmeister. Around this time, Bach began to codify his personal style of composition. He incorporated elements from all the music he had studied as he developed his musical thinking in ways that would apply to all vocal and instrumental genres, way beyond a keyboard focus. For example, while in Weimar, Bach began drafting the Brandenburg Concertos, the sonatas and partitas for solo violin, and the solo cello suites. As Bach was expanding his work as a composer, he welcomed the chance that came with his promotion to compose 1 cantata per month for the court chapel. In fact, the genesis of the A Mighty Fortress cantata comes from this period. During the next year, 1715, as he was turning 30, Bach modernized his scoring for strings, switching from the traditional German and French 5 parts to the Italian practice of writing for 4 strings with 1 viola instead of 2. This, along with his adoption of the modern Italian concerto, brought Bach clearly into the present, looking to the future. We sometimes read about Bach being old-fashioned, looking back to the past century, but that simply isn't true. Bach made a steady practice of keeping up with the latest musical styles from Italy, France, and beyond. Clearly, Bach was a unique composer, but he was definitely not an old-fashioned one. We look at Bach's music overall and see that it is endlessly inventive, complex, and emotionally powerful. What's remarkable is that these qualities were already present in 1715 when Bach was 30 years old. The fashionable Vivaldi style was a pretty big deal, so we should hear how Bach handles it. A good example comes from Bach's time in Köthen, where he supplied concertos for the prince's entertainment. We'll listen to the first movement of the concerto in A minor for violin, strings, and the foundational basso continuo, a low string playing the bass line and a harpsichord playing harmonies. You'll hear the whole ensemble play the striking ritornello, then a middle section featuring the solo violin punctuated with orchestral references to the memorable opening measures. The movement closes with a return to the ritornello. And by the way, Bach could have easily played the solo part. According to his son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, in his youth and until the approach of old age, he played the violin cleanly and powerfully. When Bach was concertmaster of the orchestra in Weimar, he got plenty of practice playing the violin. He had traded his earlier position at the keyboard for that of the first violin and leader of the orchestra. Later, as Kapellmeister or director of music for the court in Köthen, he likely continued to play the violin. Let's listen, see if it reminds you of Vivaldi. Thank you. Okay, did it sound like Vivaldi? Yeah? Maybe Vivaldi kicked up a notch? But it really, you probably would have trouble saying whether it was Vivaldi or Bach. But definitely very happy music. Any other thoughts about this movement?
I guess they were contemporaries.
Yeah, pretty much. Vivaldi was a little bit older.
I don't know
that he ever heard it. Because music did get transferred, but if it wasn't printed, I don't know. It seemed that more often music came from Italy north than from north down to Italy. That's just kind of how it went. But it's possible. I'm sure he knew about Bach and respected Bach.
My thought would be, yeah, if he heard it,
No. In this time, there just wasn't any concept of plagiarism at all. Yeah. This was, as we've talked about, this was just the musical language. And this was not, these were Bach's original ideas. It's just, you could tell that the style was very much like Vivaldi. But, and we've also talked about how composers copy from themselves, and they borrow from old works and put in new works, and that concept just didn't even exist. In fact, it was considered an honor to take something from an earlier composer or somebody else's music and use it in yours. So, any other ideas about it? Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of Vivaldi's music described as feathery, as though there were a lot of little lines and you could sort of see between them, and I was kind of listening for that in there. I think it is there.
Yeah.
Is the beat more like the volume? Because that in the seasons.
Yeah.
You hear that.
Yeah.
Strong first beat.
Right. Well, that's part of the style. Yeah. Yeah, for fast movements. Yeah. Yeah. Any other reactions? We've talked mostly about sacred music, so I thought I had to throw in something secular, because we know he also dedicated his secular music to God. But any other reactions to it? Okay. Now let's talk a little bit more about the Bach style and listening to Bach. You can listen, study, and appreciate Bach on multiple levels. While complexity is often present, the music is still accessible, easy to hear and hear again. You can work to understand it deeply, or you can take it as it is. Bach works for children as well as for the most sophisticated musician. Bach's music never gets boring to perform or listen to. In many ways, it is amazing, and I don't use that word very often. For performers, the music may be challenging, but it's logical and usually idiomatic. In other words, the music falls easily within the technique of the performer. For a keyboardist, it fits under the fingers. And yet, it's far from predictable. Most pieces contain tricky passages. Even the simplest pieces, like the first organ piece we heard, you would have thought that was simple, but oh, it's really very tricky. It has some tricky spots. So, that's a given, tricky passages, but they still make sense, and they make the music more interesting. The same goes for harmonies. Bach's music is filled with rich harmonies that may be surprising, but they are completely logical and, frankly, very satisfying to perform. The harmonies of some Bach pieces sound more like the late 19th century than the 18th. The examples are many in vocal and instrumental music, but a short and fairly simple one comes to my mind because it's so rewarding to perform. It's the early, not late, chorale prelude, Erbarm dich mein, O Herrgott. Have mercy on me, O God, a penitential text based on Psalm 51. The prelude consists of a series of intense yet calm, rich chord progressions under the unadorned chorale tune. The chords would probably remind you more of Brahms or Reger than Bach. We don't have time to listen to it now, but it's on YouTube and the information's on your handout. We've talked about how Bach worked within the style of his time, putting his own stamp on it. This was his musical language, and it had a vocabulary of techniques, melodic ideas, formulas for cadences, a whole array of ornaments to decorate melodies, and instrumental figurations, patterns suitable to a given instrument. Think of the fast, agitated sounding back and forth in violin writing. You heard it in the concerto that we just listened to. All of Bach's techniques were part of the Baroque style, and he applied them with exquisite skill and imagination. Much of the complexity in Bach comes from his masterful use of counterpoint, a musical texture where each horizontal line is melodic, functioning both independently and together because all the lines must fit harmonically. Counterpoint usually includes imitation, where one line states an idea and the others enter one by one with the same idea. And then the whole texture spins out to a cadence, a brief resting point. The process repeats, and there is much musical invention through it all. This is the basic idea of a fugue. And Bach was a supreme expert at writing fugues. He also used canons, where one voice follows another exactly at either the octave or another interval, such as a fifth or fourth. Here is where the mathematicians love Bach. You would think the result might be tedious, but we know it isn't. Bach's ultimate goal was creating beautiful music, and he never let his techniques get in the way of that. A good example of this is the canonic variations for organs on the Christmas tune Vom Himmel hoch, which we heard earlier. Bach wrote 5 expansive variations, all using the canon technique. They are absolutely beautiful. Whether you notice the canons or not, this is a brilliant work and a good addition to your Christmas playlist. Bach was also comfortable writing in a more harmonic style, especially for orchestra. And he composed many beautiful melodies with an understated accompaniment. You probably know the famous Air on the G String from the 3rd Orchestral Suite. I could go on, but basically, Bach had a remarkably varied musical language. And that's one reason why you can never really exhaust the riches of Bach. And so, listening to Bach must be a good thing. For us as Christians, listening to Bach is a sure way to feel the presence of God. We can listen to lots of other music, but it's a healthy spiritual discipline to keep a little Bach with you. It can be your personal favorites, at least to start, and then you can gradually add more works over time. For me personally, I always have some Bach going on in my organ practice. I can't imagine doing otherwise. No matter how you get it, Bach truly is good for the soul. For more of a challenge, you might go to the John and Matthew Passions and the B minor Bass, which are treasures for listening on many levels and for learning the Bach style in a profound way. The same goes for the cantatas, but on a smaller scale. If you prefer instrumental music, there is much to choose from, but I would include the Musical Offering, the Goldberg Variations, and the Art of Fugue, introspective works of the mature Bach. For sheer pleasure, the Brandenburg Concertos and the Orchestral Suites are an uplifting starting point. They may not be sacred, but they will lift your spirits. For a sacred lift, the Magnificat and Christmas Oratorio are glorious, especially useful for fighting the commercialization of Christmas. The list could go on and on. And I would love to hear about your listening experiences, and I'm always happy to offer suggestions. But now, we need to have some time for discussion. So, questions, thoughts, ideas. I know you have them.
Where did he sit?
Yeah. Yeah, there was just like a ladder, kind of little stairwell. That it was quite a journey up there. Yeah. Yes. As an organist or as a composer, it was probably Handel. For organs in England, organs at that time didn't have pedals. So they were it was a completely different animal. And the music was different. Handel did write organ concertos that were played during intermissions when his oratorios were performed. And they are all for manuals only with orchestra. And you get, especially earlier, there's some lovely music, all for manuals. It's just of a totally different type. And you didn't find pieces based on hymns very often. You found some, but not many. Usually voluntaries. You've heard of Purcell's trumpet tune and Clark's trumpet voluntary. And ceremonial music was always big in England. Yes.
I don't know this for a fact, you probably do, but it seems to me that there's a lot of Bach that shows up in sort of more contemporary settings. I don't know, we used to have, back in the days of albums, we had one by a group known as the Swingle Singers.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sort of it was Bach, but it was, I think the rhythm was changed a little bit.
Yeah, they didn't change the rhythm, they just sang all the instrumental parts. So, pop, 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 pop. Yeah, 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 yeah. I grew up on the Swingle Singers. I love them. Yeah, they're just great. Absolutely. And if you listen to Hey Jude from the Beatles, I'm pretty sure they snatched that from Bach.
It would be interesting if somebody would go through and catalog all the places.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Eric, you had a...
Yeah, did he have any specific position on the Reformation itself as for allegiances to Catholicism?
Well, you know, he was a dyed-in-the-wool Lutheran. I mean, and that's what we talked about last week, how Luther informed his life from the day he was born, but he was a totally dedicated Orthodox Lutheran. And in his time, when other kind of currents were flowing, one called Pietism, which caused a lot of trouble, Bach stuck straight with Luther. Absolutely, yeah. But you know, he and the Lutherans absorbed some Calvinist tunes, as we saw. Actually, quite a few of them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Probably no answer to this, but following up on Eric's question... Bach thought as a Lutheran, ideas, theological ideas, and things like that. But as a musician, how do you think? I mean, I often wonder about where are musical ideas, what they are, and where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
A musical idea is not a word, it's not a thought, it's not a proposition, it's different. Only musicians seem to know what these are.
Yeah.
And there's this book by Philip Glass, you know, that's currently published. He writes about the process of composition. But what the heck is a musical idea? Where do they come from? How did Bach, first in history, ever express what he expressed with sound?
That's a really hard question. But you know what? I have to start with education, study. He studied a whole lot of music, other people's musical ideas. So he didn't start with nothing. He studied people from the Renaissance. He studied people from the early 17th century for keyboard writing, for other instruments, for vocal writing, and he absorbed all of everything he could from this music. And he just happened to be exceptionally gifted and was exceptionally creative with his own musical ideas. But they really came from somewhere else originally. I mean, if you listen to the music that comes before, you can see where he got his ideas. Yeah, I'm always talking about the 17th century, but that really, that's very important. Buxtehude in Lübeck and Böhm and Hamburg and all those composers influenced him very, very strongly.
But yet there's something in him that never was before. It's like the sermon that
Right. Well, it's because he worked so very hard his entire life. He was gifted, but he worked at it. He always wanted to reach a higher goal. He kept fiddling with his music. That's why he went back years later to these early organ chorales and made this beautiful collection of expanded and revised works, because he wanted to make them ever better. And I do think he relied on God's help to make it happen. He did. Any more questions? Maybe you'll think of a question, but before we run out of time, I thought I might say a little bit about the postlude this morning, because it's a real treat. If you heard it at 8:30, you'll know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't heard it, you'll be blown away. Right, Bobby? John, you were there. Okay. John told me afterwards, he said, "This just sounds like Bach wrote it yesterday, very fresh." It's a wonderful, wonderful piece. It's the Sinfonia from Cantata 29. And what's interesting about it, it's an opening movement to the cantata. And this opening movement was taken from one of Bach's partitas for solo violin, the opening prelude. And it's a very virtuosic violin part, really, really hard. And he took it and put it in this cantata, and the organ basically had the virtuoso violin part. So when you hear the organ playing that, you can sort of hear the sound of the violin. That was already there in the cantata along with other instruments. This transcription, the organ plays it all, so you can imagine how hard it is. And it's very grand because it's another one of those city council cantatas. We heard one last week. It was for the incoming new city council. And at times like that, there was a lot of money flowing. And so Bach could write these very grand pieces. And this cantata is just quite beautiful. And lots of resources, and very big. And I read someone recently who said that these city council cantatas combined the adulation of the city council with the glorification of God. And they do, because they're essentially sacred works, but well worth a listen to the whole cantata if you want to find it on YouTube. It's quite uplifting. Yeah.
One more unanswerable question.
What am I going to do with you?
So, do you think it will be better than any music you've ever heard?
That is unanswerable, because I just simply don't know. And so I think life is short, and so I try to listen to as much beautiful music as I can, and I try to play as much beautiful music as I can, and I don't waste my time on rubbish music. I just don't have time for it. So I try to make my own heaven on earth. You know, the kingdom is here, and Bach is a big part of that kingdom.
Could you say that Bach was a true Renaissance person, in that he had other skills and arts that he developed other than music?
Not really. No, he was very focused on his music. He did other things, like he collected musical instruments. He would even buy and sell them, rent them. He was involved in designing organs and consulting with churches building organs. He was a recitalist, virtuoso recitalist. This is all musical, though. And he also helped to create a new kind of keyboard instrument that was kind of like a harpsichord, but it had a lute-type mechanism, so it had a much softer sound, and that's called the Lautenwerk. And after Bach's time, it just kind of went by the wayside. He was also instrumental in helping some builders perfect the forte piano, which came eventually to be our piano. I mean, he was very, very critical. Oh, the action is not right. You've got to work on this. You've got to work on that. And the builder was like, oh, you're making my life difficult. But in the end, he said, thank you, Sebastian. You have really helped. You've made a better instrument. So, again, he was very much with the times. But I don't think he was an intellectual who, like, read philosophy. He read theology. He read what was applicable to his profession as a church musician. So, yeah, Art.
Two questions. Is that Brandenburg Concerto, is that the whole concerto, or is that the one part?
This is the whole score to one movement, the first movement of the third. So, I mean, it goes on for pages and pages and pages. But what you see is, like, the instruments. There are winds, and then strings, and then lower strings, and at the bottom. So it's called a score. So each different instrument is lined up. So that shows you how many instruments are playing. They were smaller. To us, they're more like chamber orchestras. But they did have winds, woodwinds, and they did have brass. Not always. It depended on the funding, if they could afford it. But definitely not like our modern symphony.
Where are all the posters gone?
With the flowers? Yeah, I think so. Are you asking, like, where are the good composers now?
Yes.
That is another hard question because it's just a matter of taste. I do think trends in composition have moved back toward music that's accessible for the listener. And sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes it's like, well, that's derivative. I've heard that before. So it's really hard to keep doing new things. Okay, I think we've run out of time. So next week it's Bach's church cantatas. Thank you.